From 90.7 WFAE Charlotte, 90.3 WFHE Hickory. Welcome to Charlotte Talks. I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins. The budget cuts have been brutal for North Carolina public schools. Federal, local, state funding have all plummeted. Over 5,000 jobs have been eliminated, and state education leaders are sounding the alarm louder than ever before. Joining us today, the president of the North Carolina Education Association, Sherry Strickland, and the executive director of the North Carolina PTA, Deborah Horton, both joining us from the studios of WUNC in Chapel Hill. Ladies, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sherry Strickland, what happened? What got us to this point?
Well, over the last 2 years in North Carolina, just like across the nation, we have seen a reduction in our state revenues. We've seen job losses, which has also have contributed to the lack of revenues in our state. And because public education is such a large part of the state budget, the result has been significant cuts to K-12 public education.
It is in fact a continuation of the economic crisis that began really over 2 years ago.
Correct.
Where do we stand as far as the state legislature is concerned in the process of next year's budget?
Well, the budget bill has already been signed by the governor. And, you know, we certainly do want to applaud the members of the General Assembly. We called on them from the beginning to fund schools first, and we do believe that they made every attempt to do that given the current and continuing economic situation. So they did some creative things, like using some lottery money for a one-time exception to the legislation about how the lottery money should be used to help save teachers' jobs. So while we are not seeing any kind of salary increase or benefit increase, we are at least anticipating that we have staved off the continuing loss of educator jobs in North Carolina.
Deborah Horton, Executive Director of the North Carolina PTA, this question. How deep are the cuts that you are ending up with now?
They're still deep. Deeper than any of us are comfortable with. And as Sherry echoed that, we appreciate what the legislature and the state leaders have done not to make those cuts any deeper. We have been able to hold the line, so to speak, but they are going to still be very dramatic in each and every one of our students' classrooms. And this is what is incredibly concerning to our parents. While the class size grows, how can those teachers do what they want to do to build the relationships and to keep a close eye on so many students in one classroom with so many needs? That's going to be a big concern around the budget cuts.
There was a rally that you sponsored back in April, all of the education groups sponsored back in April, based on the fact of just how deep the cuts were last year. So let's go back. How deep were the cuts last year? And then was your rally effective in April in making the cuts this year less severe?
This is Sherry. We do believe that our rally was successful. One of the great benefits, I guess, of challenging economic times has been that associations like the North Carolina Association of Educators and NCPTA, the school administrators and school boards associations, have all come together and worked hand in hand to be sure that we were sending a strong and cohesive message to the members of the General Assembly, which again basically boiled down to funding schools first, to being sure that they built this year's budget around providing adequate funding to public schools before really looking at other parts of the state budget. But we were wanting to be sure that everyone was aware of the significance of the cuts from last year and that we really just could not sustain a similar kind level of cuts in this year's budget and not just the devastating impact on public schools.
Give us some perspective here. How much are we talking about in terms of cuts and maybe even jobs lost in the, what would it have been, the 2009-2010 school budget year versus the 2010-2011 budget year? Some hard, fast numbers, last year versus this year.
Well, and this is Sherry again. Last year we saw about $409 million in cuts to public schools. And besides the programmatic cuts that were significant and deep to things like professional development and funding for children with disabilities and funding for our high-risk children, we lost about 5,500 jobs. And, you know, that's not just classroom teacher jobs, but it's also teacher assistants and bus drivers and custodians and cafeteria workers. And what we know in public schools is that when anyone loses a job, that work is still there and it has to be picked up by the remaining staff in that school. So going into the next budget cycle, we were anticipating additional discretionary cuts that would be pushed down to the school systems that could have resulted in, you know, another two or three thousand job losses, bringing us to perhaps close to 10,000 jobs. But the use of the lottery money and cutting in some other areas to help put additional funding into K-12 public schools has helped to prevent a lot of that from happening.
And in what way? I mean, again, I'm looking for specific numbers. We ended up with how big of a cut in the state education budget this year compared to last year? How many jobs lost this year compared to last year?
Well, Chris, this is Deborah. There won't be, thankfully, the deepest of those cuts that we had anticipated. That is both thankfulness on an economic standpoint as well as for what's happening in those classrooms. The other issue is we are still breaking those numbers down, and we are looking not only at the state dollars, but what's happening with the local budgets now that are going to have to either supplement or making their own cuts. And so it may be difficult in each and every LEA to say where those numbers are coming from, because we hope that they're also being, we know that they're being as creative as they were at the state level to continue to keep those cuts at a minimum that affect the classroom. Unfortunately, there's going to be savings of things like, you know, there's not going to be new buses that are going to be rolling. It's going to be repairing buses. And so we have to think about all of those pieces. So it's LEA to LEA may be one way to describe the how difficult it is sometimes to wrap your hands around the absolute numbers in each and every school system.
Suffice it to say then, if I'm understanding this correctly, that you guys were hitting the panic button in April because of what happened last year and you were afraid that that was going to happen again this year. However, here we are in nearing mid-July and the budget has already been signed off on and it's not as bad as you thought it was going to be.
That is correct, and we are thankful for that. But we do believe, because, as Sherry said, that we came together with the Department of Public Instruction and the state superintendent and all of the state-level stakeholders in education to say, whoa, let's get a handle on this now. And we think having those conversations starting even back in January, February, and really melding our message in April, that is one of the big significant pieces that kept that story from being as bad as we were anticipating it could be.
Are there some adjustments that you are finding that are going to be difficult to implement? You alluded to the fact that you're not going to be buying new school buses, for example. You're going to be repairing some of the existing ones. Are there other examples of things that you're doing that educators across the state and administrators across the state are having to do that they wish they didn't have to do?
Chris, this is Sherry. I think, yes, absolutely. We are continuing to see from last year and going into this year significant cuts to professional development opportunities for our teachers. You know, we want to be sure that our teachers are current and that they have the kind of training they need to deal with the variety of children that they encounter in their classrooms. And a lot of that professional development money is gone. Textbook money is absolutely gone. not just money to buy new, adopt new textbooks, but even to replace textbooks that may no longer be usable. So superintendents and school boards and principals are going to have to find very creative ways to deal with those kinds of problems. Things like mentors for new teachers, all the mentor money is gone. So principals are going to need to do other things to try to be sure that new teachers, our youngest teachers, are receiving the help and support that they need to be as effective as possible for the students that they teach. So a lot of the supports that we have worked so hard to get into place in our school systems are now gone. And when we come out of this economic recovery, we are concerned that we're going to have to go back to the drawing board and try to get all of those things put back in place that took us years to get to.
But, you know, listening to this and hearing you talk about the adjustments that you're having to make in repairing existing school buses as opposed to buying new ones, maybe using textbooks a year or two longer than you had originally planned, sounds like, so what? Everybody's having to adjust. Every state agency is having to adjust. Everybody's having to adjust in their personal lives to meet the new demands of these new economic times. So how do you respond to that?
I don't say it's true that every family is adjusting to the way that they lived their lives, but we're talking about a bigger picture here. We're talking about creating a foundation for successful living with a good, sound education. And that starts, you know, at birth almost, but certainly within our school system. I think every student deserves those opportunities to have the best of their education, because that is an economic future for them, other families, and certainly for the state of North Carolina. So we're making an investment when we give a little more to education, because we're very concerned too about, you know, we're creating these global students. We're creating students for a 21st century. So they need equipment in their classrooms. They need technology to be the latest. They need teachers that have the latest professional development. And again, all of that is a bigger investment than maybe the cuts that we're all having to take in the changing of our lives. We're creating a foundation here for our economic future.
Does the fact that North Carolina does not have the best history for education funding, especially in recent years, are you sensitive to that nomenclature, so to speak?
Yes, Chris, this is Sherry. Absolutely. We have seen over the past 30 or so years the percentage of the state budget going to public education decline by about 17%. And when we look at North Carolina compared to states around us and across the nation, we see that we are not spending a comparable amount or percentage of our taxable resources on public education. And while I really do feel like we've made some significant positive gains in public education over the last few years, we really are very concerned to see us going backwards at this point.
That's Sherry Strickland, president of the North Carolina Education Association. We're also joined by Deborah Horton, executive director of the North Carolina PTA. Our discussion about the state of education in North Carolina will continue on Charlotte Talks right after this.
Charlotte Talks made possible in part this morning by AEG Live, presenting Grammy Award-winning musician Melissa Etheridge on her Fearless Love Tour on Thursday, July 22nd at Ovens Auditorium. Tickets available online at Ticketmaster.com. Well, anyone who drives to South Carolina on Interstate 85 is sure to know the iconic water tower painted to look like a peach. Well, indeed, South Carolina is peach country, but there's much, much more to the juicy summer fruit than meets the eye. We'll find out everything that we want to know about peach varieties, growing that fragile fruit, and its very short window of growing time in the summer, and, of course, how to cook with it. Join us for a peachy edition of Charlotte Talks Monday morning at 9. Mike Collins will be back in the studio. We'll be back to this conversation in just a moment.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The administration challenges Arizona's immigration law. BP sets a new date for capping its gushing well. And the White House touts an increase in exports.
That's the Diane Rehm Show, this and each weekday morning, right after Charlotte Talks, from 10 to noon, on your NPR news source, 90.7 WFAE.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins, Sherry Strickland, president of the North Carolina Education Association, Deborah Horton, executive director of the North Carolina PTA, joining us from the studios of WUNC Radio in Chapel Hill to talk about the state of education in North Carolina. And both of you sound terribly much more optimistic than you did just a couple of months ago.
That's true, and we're glad to have that attitude now. We were concerned a few months ago.
What were the creative ways that the state legislature, or how did the state the budget people get creative? Have you heard, were there cuts in other areas so that they could provide for education?
Well, one of the things that the legislature did was to look at the lottery money and to use lottery money that was sitting in additional revenue instead of for the four areas that the general statute provides for the lottery money to be used for. They did a one-time emergency use of the lottery money to save jobs in our school system. So that was certainly a positive move, and we applaud that move on behalf of the legislators. But there were also some other things that were done. There were some cuts to some of the university funding that did help K-12 education, things like support for out-of-state athlete scholarships and some of those kinds of things that were cut in the university budget that were then able to be shifted over into the K-12 budget.
When you launched your Fund Schools First campaign really back in January, capped off with a rally in April as the legislative session was getting well underway, part of your argument was, speaking of public universities and public colleges in North Carolina, that they received and they have been able to maintain a certain level of funding from the state government over the years, whereas K-12 education has been lax in that particular area. Are you saying that they indeed went through colleges and public university budgets were slashed to make room for K-12 this year?
Chris, it's Deborah. I wouldn't say that they were slashed, but we do certainly support a world-class higher education community in North Carolina. But that needs to be supported also with a world-class public education community, because the stronger that our K-12 system is, then the less remediation. When I'm hearing that, 50% of the students entering community college has to go to some remediation, then we need to strengthen the K-12 situation. And I don't think that it was an either or for our legislators. It was, let's see what we can do to help both. And while in years past there might have been less cuts to the higher ed community, this time around it was less cuts to the public education, and looking at each and every budget line item for the higher ed community and seeing where those places were, if we took some of those operational dollars and maybe gave it back to the classroom, maybe there wouldn't be some of those needs. The ultimate is that we want both of these groups to have world-class teaching and learning in North Carolina.
If you want to join our discussion, our phone numbers are 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 1-800-603-9323 if you're outside the Charlotte area. Our email address and the social website contacts can be found at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Aren't you, and have you been, overreacting on this whole education funding issue?
Chris, this is Sherry. No, absolutely not. When we saw from last year what impact there was on our students from the cuts that we experienced, when we looked at the higher class sizes and we looked at the fact that in some of our high schools, subjects were not able to be taught because there was not a teacher there to teach those subjects. And when we think about the numbers of children that we have that right now are not being successful in school, and we need to provide appropriate resources and supports for those kids, I don't think that we are being at all overreactive to be concerned about what might happen if we continue down this road. As Deborah was talking about, if we cannot provide a high-quality education for every single child that enters our schools in K-12 and keep them all in school and have them graduate successfully and ready to move on in their life and their careers, then the economic impact to North Carolina's future will continue to be significant.
Going forward, are we going to see fewer teachers still with fewer resources? Are we still going to see teachers bringing their own supplies to the classroom?
I would say at least in this coming year we are. While our top priority was to save jobs, and it appears that that has been a successful top priority, there are still lots of other areas that are going to go underfunded. And things like just classroom supplies and resources certainly may be part of that. A lot of the dollars for those kinds of things are local dollars, though, and depending on the local's ability to provide some additional funding in schools, we may see some differences across the state in those kinds of things. But we do know that teachers historically have spent out-of-pocket money, averaging right now about $750 per teacher, to supplement what the school is able to provide in just the kind of consumable supplies that you need in your classroom every year.
Let's go to the phone lines. Olivia in Charlotte, thanks for calling in, Olivia.
Yes, I'm wondering if we've looked at changing the school week to be Monday through Thursday, or a four-day week, to cut back in expenses.
Sherry Strickland, you want to tackle that?
Sure. One of the things that we do know is that decreasing by one day does not save a huge amount of money relative to the entire budget. Teachers are still paid under their state salary, so you wouldn't see significant savings there. And I think there's a perception that, you know, the amount of money that you're going to save on transportation and electricity in the school buildings results in a lot of savings, when actually most of the money for public education is really people money. It pays salaries, it pays benefits. And the other thing is, you know, right now when we're looking at being more globally competitive, competing with other countries that actually go to school more hours a day, more days during the year than we do right now, going backwards to less face time between teachers and students, again, is exactly the wrong direction that we want to go right now. And the impact it would have on our kids' education would not be justified by the minimal amount of savings that would result from it.
Are there some other alternatives out there that you can think of, Olivia, where the educational systems, the school systems around the state could save money?
No, that's just, I know that there have been some states that have made that choice, and so I was just curious if that's something that North Carolina has looked at.
Thanks for your phone call, Olivia.
Thank you.
Sherry, any other ideas from your standpoint, or Deborah?
Chris, I think that North Carolina, both all of the education associations working with the Department of Public Instruction and with the legislature, have really done a good job of researching and looking at a lot of different options for how we could save dollars. But what we haven't done is say, well, it needs to be less instruction time. So we're really glad that all of us agree, and I think our families agree, that having the most amount of learning time is what's important, whether that's longer school days, whatever that takes to be sure that our children have the maximum amount of instruction. But I think there's been lots of creative ideas that have been put forth, whether it's what your caller mentioned, shorter school weeks. But the ultimate is protecting instructional time for our students, because we have a dropout crisis. Mm. We have kids who are leaving high school now, and they didn't finish their learning cycle. And we've got to do whatever we can to turn that tide around. And a lot of that is around building relationships with these students in the classroom, with teachers, mentors, caring adults. And the most amount of that time that we can give will help to turn that dropout as well as our educational crisis around.
And the dropout issue is a nationwide issue. I think the U.S. ranks now, 16th among developed nations, I should say, advanced nations, in the high school dropout category? Or it ranks very high, I should say.
It does rank very high, and it is a concern to all of us, and it's very concerning to our policymakers. They've put a significant amount of funding in to help to create ways in each and every community through a grant process that will turn around dropouts, allowing that to be community-driven. And keeping these teachers in the classroom is another tool that will be a great way to help keep our students in school and making learning relevant, providing the technology that's needed for learning, creating the expectations that the best way to come out of economic crisis is to have well-educated workforce that is participating in society. So I think all of these things will help to turn that tide around.
Gina writes in on one of our websites, Dr. Gorman has brought up removing four-year-old education from the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools' responsibility and budget. Do your organizations have a position on this, and what do you think about public education for four-year-olds?
This is Sherry. I think we have already seen a significant impact from both our Smart Start and More at Four programs that make sure that our neediest children have the opportunity to get into the school system and to be with trained professionals to help them with those pre-readiness skills that they need to be able to be successful kindergartners. We have seen significant budget cuts to both of those programs in the last 2 years because of our funding issues. And I think that that's of great concern to us as well, especially our children from poverty who need to be in a stimulating environment so that they will be ready to be successful when they enter kindergarten. We firmly believe that is one of the most important things that we can do is to get our children off to a really good start so that they don't end up struggling and are behind almost from the day that they start K-12 public education.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Please finish.
Well, I just wanted to say that we absolutely disagree with Dr. Gorman's position if that is something he is seriously looking at. I believe that would be, again, the wrong direction to be going in terms of improving outcomes for our students.
What is the one profound change in the way the education system is being administered in North Carolina that we all on the outside can look at that bothers you the most?
Wow, that's deep.
Yeah.
And can go a long way. I don't know that we can pinpoint one.
Is there an adjustment? Is there one single adjustment that you wish you didn't have to make?
Oh, yeah. When you're talking about dollars themselves impacting the classroom, we certainly wish that we didn't have to have increased class size. I think that is a pinpoint area for PTA, for all of our groups that were part of the Fund Schools First campaign, because that is huge effects when you've gone from putting, say, 27 kids to almost 40 kids in a high school classroom. And the number one reason that we're hearing for dropouts is that children or that these students don't have relationships, that they weren't able to connect with someone. Well, it's really hard for one person in a classroom to 38 to 40 students all needing something different to build that relationship. And then if you, you know, topple that with eight classes a day, classroom size is a really big concern as we go through these tough times.
An excellent answer. Let's go back to the phone lines here. Ellen is calling in from Charlotte with a great question. Ellen, you there? Ellen. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
My name is Ellen Martin, and I'm a huge public schools advocate. I've been on the equity committee for many years at Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools, and I'm a college counselor. My question is, I think that we have a really easy fix to getting more money and saving it without getting rid of any services. And I wrote a letter to the editor. I don't understand why our universities in the UNC system give a huge discount to out-of-state students. When you look at other schools and other out-of-state universities, for example, the University of Virginia, they charge $10,000-plus more dollars for their out-of-state students. Why are we giving a bargain to our out-of-state students? I agree we should help our in-state, but we're such a well-esteemed university. Chapel Hill is so desirable. Why are we charging them such a discounted rate for their tuition?
If you want an argument, Ellen, I don't think our guests are going to ask you to pick another subject.
Why haven't we done that?
Yeah, exactly.
Where are we? Why aren't we doing that? That's so much easier. The whole athletic scholarship, that's great, but that's a drop in the bucket regarding savings.
All right. Sherry?
We have 18% out-of-state students. That would be fabulous, even if each one just paid $10,000 more a year.
Well, I think what we need is for the legislators to hear your same message from many, many, many more of their constituents. I think historically, again, when we look at the percentage of budget that is going to the university system compared to K-12, we have seen that many of our especially high-ranking, powerful members of the General Assembly put a lot of emphasis on the university system. And again, we certainly want North Carolina to have the best, the very best system of higher ed in the country as well. But we agree that right now, when times are as difficult as they are, that we need to make that foundation of K-12 the priority and to recognize that the only way that K-12 public education receives funding is through tax dollars. That's it. That's all we have.
Right. That's the state budget.
Exactly. So we have no opportunity to charge or raise tuition or to create endowments or any of those kinds of things that at least are available as options. We can't put a cap on how many people are going to come in our public school doors because everybody who moves into an area is going to be eligible to go to public school. So that is exactly why, while we never intended, and I don't think we did, pit ourselves against the university system in this year's budget, we just felt like we had to take a clear stand that K-12 public education needed to come first.
Ellen, Ellen, thanks so much for your phone call.
Thank you so much.
Our discussion about the state of education in North Carolina will continue on listener-funded public radio, WFAE. Right after this.
Charlotte Talks this morning made possible in part by the 63rd Annual Craft Fair of the Southern Highlands, featuring works by members of the Southern Highland Craft Guild, July 15th through 18th at the Asheville Civic Center. info@craftguild.org. It's Friday, and that means the News Roundup coming up on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock. The administration challenges Arizona's immigration law. BP sets a new date for capping its gushing well, and the White House touts an increase in exports. A panel of journalists joins Diane for analysis of the week's top national news stories. You can join this program now to talk more about the state of education in North Carolina at 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 1-800-603-WFAE, or wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. We're back to this conversation in 30 seconds.
Enjoy an evening of fun and games with WFAE. we're going to be at Revolution Pizza in Noda for trivia night. You can play on the WFAE team or compete against our staff for prizes and bragging rights. We'll see you Wednesday, July 14th at 8 p.m. Find out more about it under the Events tab on our website, WFAE.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Chris Clackham, sitting in for Mike Collins, Sherry Strickland, president of the North Carolina Education Association, and Deborah Horton, executive director of the North Carolina PTA, are our guests today talking about the state of education in the state of North Carolina. And the last caller, guys, made an excellent point. Ellen was talking about how colleges and universities certainly have alternatives in ways to raise revenue. You guys were pointing out that K through 12 public schools do not have good alternatives, but or do not have any alternatives. Is that correct?
Correct.
I do want to, at this point, talk about, though, what's called alternative compensation, the concept that many school systems do, in fact, supplement teachers' pay. Is there something being thought of on a statewide basis for alternative and supplemental compensation for teachers?
This is Sherry. Well, right now in North Carolina, our teachers all are on a statewide salary schedule. And that salary schedule provides additional salary for years of experience and also for education level. So as a teacher achieves a master's degree or national board certification or even a PhD or EdD, there is additional salary that goes with that. Of course, that salary has been frozen for this past year and in this coming year. But there are locals who are able to provide a supplement to teachers as well. And in North Carolina, that can be a significant amount of money added to a teacher's salary. But then there are also smaller, more rural locals that are not able to supplement salaries at all. And so there's zero local dollars going into teacher's salary. But when we talk about alternative compensation, usually what people are talking about is what may be more commonly called pay for performance, which is when you look at student outcomes and try to find some way to tie teacher salary to whether or not they are effectively impacting student outcomes, which so far has not been a very successful way of looking at paying teachers, because student outcomes there are many ways to look at student outcomes besides just a test score, and because what might be an appropriate way to look at student outcomes for a high school math teacher would not be an appropriate way to look at student outcomes for a preschool teacher of kids with autism, let's say. So it's very complicated when you start looking at trying to pay teachers in a different way than a salary schedule.
But Jeff writes in and wants to challenge you on that whole issue of there are no alternatives for raising revenue or cutting cost that public schools can have. And he suggests that we should, quote, get public schools out of the transportation business. Instead, contract with public transit to provide that service. This is common in high-density areas like New York City. So, as a suggestion, there are some alternatives out there that school systems can slash cost and therefore save money. What do you think about something like that, Sherry?
Well, you know, I think in maybe perhaps in a high density area, there may be some value to at least considering that, though we already own thousands of school buses across our state. I don't know how it would save money to suddenly scrap the use of all of those buses that are already owned by the public school system. And we have to recognize that a very high percent of North Carolina is very rural. Mm-hmm. And there is no high density in the western part of the state or the northeast corner of the state. So, you know, people who live in an area like the Charlotte metro area may not be thinking about the geography that is typical across the rest of the state.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Amy in Union County is calling in. Amy, thanks for your call. Amy, you there?
Are you there?
Yes, ma'am. Thanks for calling in.
I teach special ed in Union County, and what I'm very worried about are our kids. We have different levels of self-contained classrooms, and one of the levels for middle and high school is basically cut this year, and those kids will move into the regular ed class. And it's so the class size will not only increase, but it will increase with an extremely diverse population of kids who sometimes, you know, are reading on a first or second grade level, and they're in a middle school or high school class, and it just makes things really, really difficult. And so we have to be really creative about how to handle this, but I'm afraid our special ed kids are truly being left behind, and we're selling it as the opposite, but it's not. Does that make sense?
It does indeed make sense. Your comments, Deborah, Sherry?
I would think that we share that concern about our special needs and our exceptional, or children with exceptionalities families. We are looking with several systems. The NCPTA has an Exceptional Children's Commission, and we try to work with experts and with other consultants and resources so that we can create some ways to help both the teacher and the families around these exceptional children. The bigger issue is to be sure that while the class size may have grown, be sure that the resources didn't diminish. That these students are still getting service from what they need for their special learning challenges or living challenges. I just want to be sure that we concentrate on the fact that, okay, you've moved to a different place, but those resources, let's hope that moved with the student.
Yeah, well, let's hope. The current plan I don't think is the best. I know it's, you know, it is what it is. But
we do so certainly want you to know that we're out there fighting for that.
Oh, I believe it.
As I said, we have a special group of volunteers that work with people across the state and nation to say, remember our exceptional families. And remember our special needs students and their teachers. We have to be there to support you. And we hope that the communities, while the state did what it could do, we hope that communities now will rally around you, rally around your school, and wrap support around those students. And let's keep them being successful.
Amy, is that system-wide, that the practice now of combining children from special education classes?
I believe it is. I went to an EC conference, and they had kind of like a plan on how to, it all has to do with being highly qualified and that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think it's a statewide thing. Isn't that right?
It is, and a lot of this is driven by, you know, No Child Left Behind and ESEA and IDEA. There's lots of both federal and state and, in some cases, local regulations that fit all of these classrooms that you as a teacher have to fall under. It's amazing how many rules and regulations that there are, and all with good intentions. But sometimes it actually keeps you from providing what you want to do for that special student.
Amy, thanks so much for your phone call on this.
Excellent
point. You know, not everyone agrees that some of the schools, the education is in shambles, and they say instead that more money and what student needs is more time, which you guys have been talking about a lot this morning, from administrators to teachers to parents. And Lisa writes in that the only way many of the schools are making it is by parent participation, their money and or time. Teachers and the state cannot do it alone. That is happening with a great deal of regularity, is it not? There are some extremely good schools out there because you have good administrators, good teachers, and most importantly, good parental participation.
Well, you know, we certainly would say amen to that. And we have been working on that for 112 years with PTA. But that's exactly right. This is not rocket science to figure out when good principals, good educators, and parents come together and sit together, plan together, have goals and objectives together for what those students are going to need. It works beautifully, and it is a terrific model. The challenge gets to be is those places where that's not there, where families are disengaged, where unfortunately we have a very small group of administrators and sometimes educators who just hadn't seen the complete realization of what parent involvement or caregiver involvement can do to advocate for their classroom. And we are working very hard with NCAE and so many others to help that come to more places. North Carolina PTA has the Parent Involvement Initiative that has been working in several counties now. And we've seen great progress in places like Anson County, where three of the schools that we were in encouraging parent involvement, for the first time, they, since No Child Left Behind, they have met AYP. And things like parent-teacher conferences going from 20% to 89% in 1 year. And again, it was about building relationships, helping those parents to understand how they could be involved and support their student. And those are some of the least engaged of our families. So it's a great opportunity now for us to even strive more to increase parent and community involvement and to look outside of the school building to see what we can do and find to help our students.
That's Deborah Horton, Executive Director of the North Carolina PTA. We're also joined today by Sherry Strickland, President of the North Carolina Education Association. Sherry, your thoughts about the charter school concept. How long has it been around in North Carolina now?
I think we are getting to more than 10 years since the charter school legislation was passed. And, of course, in North Carolina, charter schools are public schools. So different from other states where they're private, privately run schools, they are chartered by our public school system, and they do come under the oversight of the Department of Public Instruction. NCAE has taken a position of supporting maintaining the 100 cap on charter schools. We continue to support that position. There was a push just in the last couple of days in the General Assembly to raise the cap to 106, and we did ask our members to contact their legislators and indicate support for maintaining the 100 cap on our charter schools. And the reason for that is that when the charter school legislation was first created, the charter schools were allowed to come out from under a lot of the requirements of traditional public schools in the hopes that they would be very creative, think out of the box, be able to come up with some innovative best practices that could then be shared and transported out into the traditional public schools, and we just have not seen that happen in North Carolina. I am not really aware of any specific learnings that have happened in charter schools that have then been implemented in traditional public schools. And when you look at student achievement, charter schools are doing no better than traditional public schools, and in many instances are doing not as well for student outcomes. And yet there is a huge amount of staff power and oversight being required at DPI just to be sure that our charter schools are financially sound and providing help and support for those kinds of things. So while there are some charter schools doing some good work out there, again, we have not seen that they are doing any better than traditional public schools. When students leave a traditional public school and go to a charter school, their funding goes with them. And if for some reason during that school year they end up coming back, the money doesn't come back with them. If they're gone for several years and then come back and have lost ground, then the traditional school is trying to catch them up again. So our position continues to be that the 100 cap on charter schools is an adequate number in North Carolina to be existing at the current time.
Another good topic for Charlotte Talks on another day. Thanks so much for that comment, Sherry. Let's go to the phone lines. Pat in Charlotte. Pat, thanks for calling in.
Hey, thanks so much. I just wanted to comment that this seems to be kind of the year that the teacher is under siege, and you were talking earlier about additional pay for teachers and pay for performance came up.
Mm.
And I know in Charlotte, we lead the state, seems mostly just layoffs these days. But pay for performance has been proven to work almost nowhere. And I wonder how you all feel about supporting it, or how the support exists at the federal level and at the state level for something that just doesn't seem to work at all.
All right, Pat, thanks so much for your question. I'm going to get your answers very quickly. Sherry?
Well, Pat is exactly right. The Obama administration and Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, much to our disappointment, seem to believe that if you pay teachers more, they'll do better. And we just absolutely don't believe that. We believe you have to pay teachers adequately and appropriately for the job that they do and the education that they have, and pay them as professionals. But the alternative compensation has not shown to be successful anymore.
Your thoughts on that, Deborah?
I quickly can say amen again. We totally agree that we just want good teachers in classrooms that are highly qualified and with backup professional development and the support that they need. And let's pay them for the services and for the expertise that they're giving and teaching and learning in North Carolina.
Deborah Horton, Executive Director of the North Carolina PTA. Sherry Strickland, President of the North Carolina Education Association. Thanks and good luck to you both.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Charlotte Talks on listener-funded public radio 90.7 WFAE.
Charlotte Talks.